Hello, welcome to the Saturn edition of your local talking newspaper, covering St Albans and the surrounding district. This edition is for the week ending September 12th, 2020. My name is Alex, I'm the editor of the programme. Due to the coronavirus, it is no longer safe to record together in our studio, so this edition is being produced from home. I'm joined remotely from their homes by Claire, Alison, Kalpana, Peter, Jilly and Ian, who'll be reading the news, and John, who'll be reading the radio listings. A massive thank you to them for helping out in these circumstances. The piece of music you have just heard was a piece I have written and recorded in the last couple of weeks, and features me playing electric, acoustic and bass guitars and mandolin. I've been meaning to include my own music for a while, but have never got around to it until now, so I do hope you enjoy it. The piece will be played in full at the end of this recording. All the news items in this recording have been taken from the Hearts Advertiser and the St Albans and Harpenden Review, and we will finish with a summary of the radio programmes we think you might enjoy over the next week. Before we go to the news, a brief word from Rob.
Hello, this is Rob Pierman. Thanks to Alex for giving me a few minutes of his programme so that I can just update you on some of the things that are going on. First of all, about the annual general meeting. Now, normally we hold this in April, but of course we couldn't this year. We put it off to September, but you won't be surprised to know that we've had to put it off again. And so what we're saying is, well, look, we anticipate the next AGM being in 2021 in April, but we'll have a date in due course. And let's hope by then we're clear of these restrictions on how many people can meet. Also, I know we keep saying about returning the wallets, and I wanted to say, first of all, thank the majority of listeners who do it regularly without any troubles. Just a few that we miss each month, and that builds up over time, and we get a little bit confused because we don't know whether somebody's not receiving them or not able to send them back. Now, we do appreciate there are difficulties at this time because perhaps not able to get out or other people are not able to come in and help. But anyway, the reason that we go on about it is that if we don't get the wallets and memory sticks back, we find it very difficult to have enough to send out the next month. So if we can have back, for instance, the one that's going out this week, if you can let us have it back within, say, 2 or 3 weeks, then we're ready for the next month of this programme. If we don't receive any wallets back from a listener, an individual listener, so say for 2 or 3 weeks, then we have to guess that there's an issue and problem. So we stop sending them out when it becomes a problem, or we make a phone call, or whatever. We'll try and do all our best to help in every which way we can. But we want to keep them going out to everybody. But as I said, thanks to the vast majority of listeners who do return them without any problems whatsoever. I want to take this opportunity also to thank the volunteers who are continuing to work from home. The producers, of course, like Alex this week, and Ian, and who's been in Spain for the last 6 weeks, but he's come back home now. And then, of course, Steve and Bill and Mark on a quarterly basis. They're all working in their own homes. They're producing the programmes. They've got volunteers who are reading and recording the news stories in their own homes and then sending them to the producer in order for them to be put into the programme. So thanks to the producers. Thanks to the readers. Thanks also to other contributors like Rupert and David Ireson. They're continuing also to record in their own homes and send material in that we can put into the programmes. Thanks also, and perhaps especially, to Mark and Sue and Robin, because they're doing the weekly chore of making 100 copies of each programme. It has to be done again in the home. They've got the machinery now in their houses to do this, and we're very grateful that that's continuing. And of course, the distribution secretaries, to whom you send back the programmes when you finish listening to them. That's Sue, Fiona, Jane, Michelle and Alison. Now, there's something else I wanted to mention, because I wanted to say thank you to all the volunteers who've been involved in the partnering scheme which we came up with at the start of lockdown. And many of you are still receiving regular phone calls from volunteers. The whole aim is to make sure that you're not stuck on your own. Lockdown was a difficult time when people were more isolated than they had been before. And many of you, the listeners, responded saying, yes, you would like somebody to ring you. And that's been going on, and I know the volunteers have enjoyed it very much, and they've sent some very nice comments in saying how much they're enjoying chatting with their listener. If there's anybody who missed out on that scheme because perhaps you were away or you didn't think it was something that you were interested in, But you would like to be involved and see if we can find a volunteer who will be able to ring you regularly, not every day, obviously, but just to check up on you and have a chat during the week. Then perhaps if you call Robin Cristoforo on 01727 866 725, 01727 866 725. He's been running the scheme, and he's got a list of who's in contact with whom, and we can see if we got some more volunteers who are now able to help with the scheme. The aim is to keep us all going in one way or the other until this wretched virus goes away. It's not easy for any of us, but we're all managing, we're all getting there, and hope you manage to stay well, stay cheerful, and I'll hand back now to Alex for the rest of the programme.
Hello, this is Claire reading. My first article is about cracking down on the COVID fight. St Albans could be heading for a COVID crisis if people continue flouting government guidelines. That is a stark warning from councillors troubled by repeated breaches of social distancing and other restrictions across the district. They include house parties, like one in Fleetville on Saturday night, and a rave at Hartwood Forest on the same date, which saw police disperse 100 people and seize generators, music equipment and Class A and B drugs. The news comes as the government bans social gatherings of more than 6 people in England from Monday, with people who ignore police fined £100, doubling with each offence to a maximum of £3,200. Council leader Chris White said, "I am becoming increasingly concerned that there is a growing belief that we are in a post-COVID world. This is far from the case, and infection rates are rising in many parts of the country, including Hearts. People must not relax. Queuing outside a pub with no social distancing or masks, such as I saw myself on Friday, will greatly increase the likelihood of infections and ultimately, especially for elderly and vulnerable people, a risk to life. The same goes for attending parties, raves, or other large gatherings. The district and county councils have written jointly to a number of pubs. We are also taking steps to improve social distancing in the market after concerns raised on Saturday. But it's all of us who need to take note. Wear a mask, avoid taking risks." Enforcement action will be taken on illegal events, and this can include fixed penalties of up to £10,000 on those organising them and penalties on everyone attending. Hearts Police are working closely with partners countrywide and at district level to address the issue of large gatherings. Chief Superintendent Richard Liversidge said, "Everyone has a role to play limiting the outbreak by following the regulations, including those about gatherings, which are now limited to 6 people, both indoors and outside."
Hello, this is Alison. My first story has the headline, "Council Crisis as Inspectors Throw Out Local Plan." A damning indictment of St Albans' local plan has thrown future developments within the district into doubt. Government planning inspectors have told SADC to either withdraw the plan from examination or they will recommend it is not adopted. They said this is because of a failure to cooperate with neighbouring local authorities over strategic matters and whether they could accommodate some of the district's housing target of 14,608 new homes. Progress of the local plan, LP, a blueprint for development within the district for the years to 2036, was halted earlier this year. In a bid to allay inspectors' concerns, SADC dropped its opposition to the Radlett Strategic Rail Freight Interchange, the SRFI, which it had earmarked for a garden village of 2,000 homes, and said there was no capacity for any other council to help them meet their housing target, a statement which is supported by Decorum Borough, Hartsmere, Watford, Three Rivers and Wellin and Hatfield District Councils, as well as Hearts County Council. The local plan was approved by the council in 2018 after extensive consultation with residents, community groups, businesses and neighbouring local authorities. It was submitted for examination last year, but this was halted when the inspectors raised their concerns about its soundness and legal compliance. But in a letter to SADC this week, planning inspectors Louise Crosby and Elaine Worthington said it was clear that the council had not met the duty to cooperate with other local authorities, and this failure could not be remedied through the examination process. They wrote, "This is a clearly very unfortunate situation, and we appreciate that it will be deeply disappointing to the council and other examination participants. However, we wish to emphasise that we have not reached these conclusions lightly and have, throughout, sought to be as pragmatic as is possible within the constraints set by legislation. The matter also hinges on specific concerns about the strategic importance of the SRFI proposals for a site to the south of the district. In 2014, the then Secretary of State, Eric Pickles, gave outline planning permission for an SRFI at the site near Park Street. This site is the location of one of the areas that the council has identified for housing in the draft local plan. In their latest letter, the inspectors say that even if the council knew that the SRFI could not be accommodated in another local authority area, it should have been discussed as a strategic matter and some acknowledgement made that it needed to be accommodated. Whilst it may not have been possible for the other local authorities to accommodate the SRFI, they may have been able to assist with accommodating some of St Albans' housing need. The inspectors make the point that there is nothing in legislation or guidance which requires there to be a realistic potential to achieve a positive outcome in duty to cooperate discussions, and that the duty is not a duty to agree, and discussions should be active and ongoing even when they seem to have hit the buffers. Furthermore, the inspectors said that they find it clear that the council had no intention of allocating the Radlett site for an SRFI in the plan, and that in allocating the site for housing to help meet its housing need, it knew that would prevent the creation of the regionally and nationally important SRFI. Councillor Jamie Day, portfolio holder for planning, said, "The council will now need to consider the detailed points made by the inspectors in their latest letter and determine what action to take. It is little wonder that the government's recent planning white paper has proposed to abolish the duty to cooperate requirements given the complexities involved. It is extremely important that we progress our local plan as soon as possible so we can manage the district's growth and provide much needed housing for local people in a sustainable and positive way, as well as acknowledge the increasingly pressing issues raised by the climate emergency."
Hello, this is Kalpana Block. And in my first article, entitled "Political Groups React to the Plan's Rejection," we consider the opinion of four St Albans councillors from across the political spectrum who have been reacting to the rejection of St Albans' local plan. To start with, Conservative group leader Councillor Mary Maynard said, "We are disappointed. This minority Liberal Democrat administration do not listen. They have been responsible for the local plan for 18 months. In that time, they cancelled most of the committee meetings dealing with the plan and excluded Conservatives from any involvement in decision-making. They did not listen to our advice that we needed to address the inspectors' concerns and refused to do so. We predicted the plan would fail if they did not respond to these concerns. Instead, they chose the easy political stunt of removing a contentious housing site. This inevitably caused the plan to fail. There was a clear factual and legal argument to be made on the duty to cooperate requirements of the local plan. Instead of doing the work needed to assemble this argument, the Liberal Democrats caved into developer pressure. Developers and landowners will make millions of pounds from a change to the plan, so of course they put on pressure. The Liberal Democrats need to start listening to our advice and work together for the sake of all our residents. It's the only way we will get the social housing and affordable homes we so desperately need." Simon Grover, Green Party councillor and leader of the Independent and Green Group, said, "This is yet another sorry chapter in this long-running saga, in which Lib Dem and Conservative administrations at St Albans have repeatedly failed to produce a local plan. Yes, the process is complicated and tough decisions need to be made, but our political leadership seems to be continually tripping up. Every time they do make it easier for developers to build whatever they like in our district, they make it harder for residents to get a settled and effective strategic plan for how our area will move forward. Labour Group leader, Councillor Mal Pakenham, said, "The second local plan was always destined to fail because it was drawn together on a false premise, that the strategic rail freight interchange site would be allocated as a garden village. The previous Conservative administration is at fault for not recognising this basic fact and leading the council into a legal cul-de-sac. The council had no legal option other than to remove the strategic rail freight interchange from the local plan in the hope that it might save the plan. The Labour Group now have real concerns that as the second local plan has failed and the inspectors quoted case law of a case that St Albans Council lost prior to them issuing their latest statement, and the inference being we haven't learnt from that court failure, that the council has the ability to present a local plan that will get past an inspector's hearing. This is of great concern to Labour councillors." Council leader Councillor Chris White said, "It's disappointing in one way, but not entirely surprising. As the inspectors made clear before, the inclusion of housing on the site already allocated by Strategic Government as a strategic rail freight interchange was a risky gamble. The inspector spotted that it had been added in by politicians at a late stage and that it should have been raised with neighbouring local authorities as part of the requirements for all aspects of emerging plans to be discussed as part of the plan-making process. Basically, in the inspector's view, it shouldn't have been there in the first place. And its inclusion could only be potentially legitimate if other councils in the area, fully informed of the previous administration's intentions, had indicated that they could not help the district with its need to accommodate all the extra homes required by central government targets. In a nutshell, the plan was fatally flawed at the time the previous administration submitted it. The reason why this administration was hoping that the plan, despite its weaknesses already identified, might make it to the finishing line is that we need to get on with the next stage. The assumptions on which it is based are out of date by some years. In particular, the draft plan does not acknowledge the vast change in the significance of the climate emergency. A new plan will be able to take into account sustainability, energy standards, green industries, energy generation and sustainable transport measures. It would also be able to give more emphasis to the city centre, which almost entirely lacks a vision, and the need for truly social housing."
Hello, this is Peter Block, and my first piece has the headline, "Cathedral shows visitors the face of Abbott from the 1400s. This article is accompanied by a reconstructed image of the abbot of the story in question. This is the face of the 15th century abbot of Wheathampstead, digitally reconstructed using state-of-the-art modern technology. The chapel of Abbot John of Wheathampstead, circa 1390 to 1465, remained undiscovered for 480 years until it was unexpectedly uncovered in December 2017 during excavations for St Albans Cathedral's new Welcome Centre. Three papal bulls that Pope Martin V had given him 40 years before were found with his skeleton, attached to the documents confirming the papal privileges he gained in 1423. Work on reconstructing his face has been carried out under the supervision of Professor Clark and Dr. Emma Pomeroy from the University of Cambridge and James Holman of the Canterbury Archaeological Trust. The reconstruction itself was performed by Professor Caroline Wilkinson of FaceLab, craniofacial identification and forensic reconstruction specialist based at Liverpool John Moores University and funded by Friends of St Albans Cathedral. To launch Heritage Open Days, 2020, a new free trail has been created for cathedral visitors to walk in Abbot John's footsteps, as well as a brand new exhibition which allows visitors to look into the eyes of this medieval monk. Visitors will discover a man of letters, of vision, and of international renown, and for the first time be able to see him face to face. The very Reverend Dr. Geoffrey John Dean of St. Albans said, "The reconstruction of Abbot John of Wheathamster's face brings him startlingly to life and immediately invites us to read his character from his features. He has an impish look, but also looks like a man who's not to be trifled with, as befits one of the most powerful ecclesiastical fixers of his day. I hope that seeing him in his human reality will raise interest in his life and in the central role of St. Albans Abbey has played in this country's history." Professor James Clark from Exeter University said, "Few contemporary portraits of monks of medieval England are known to survive. This facial reconstruction of John of Wheathamstead offers the first accurate representation of a monastic figure in England before 1500. John of Wheathamstead was one of the most important and influential abbots of St. Albans. Unusually, he held the office of abbot twice, from 1420 to 1440, retiring through ill health, and then from 1452 to 1465. He was a strong abbot who introduced internal reforms, promoted the abbey's property interests through much litigation, and secured papal privileges for the abbey. He instigated many building and decoration projects during his abbacies, both in the abbey church and in the monastic buildings. Some are still visible today. He was a widely read scholar who promoted learning amongst the monks and book production in the monastery. He wrote and copied books on many subjects, including an encyclopedia, the Granarium. John was amongst the first to promote the new humanist writing in England and corresponded with scholars in Italy. He was also one of the leading Benedictine abbots in England and represented the English clergy at international conferences, e.g., for example, Pavia, 1423. He met and corresponded with the Pope. He cultivated the acquaintance of those in power. The King, Henry VI, a minor until 1437, the Protector, Duke Humphrey of Gloucester, and leading nobles. They visited the Abbey, and their relationship was often marked by conferring on them membership of the Fraternity of St. Alban. People of lower status were also invited to join the fraternity after a gift or particular service to the abbey. In due course, Abbot John's body will be laid to rest again in St. Albans Abbey Cathedral, with proper prayer and ceremony. Heritage Open Days runs from Friday, September the 11th, until Sunday, September the 20th.
Hi, I'm Gilly. Judge retires after decades of service in Crown Courts. A popular and respected Crown Court judge retired on Friday after a long career delivering justice in Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire. Judge Andrew Bright QC spent 30 years as a barrister and became a QC, regularly appearing at both Luton Crown Court and St Albans Crown Court. He became a judge in 2007 and presided over cases as resident judge of St Albans from 2010 to 2018 and then as a judge at Luton from 2018. His most high-profile case at St Albans was the 2017 trial of Ian Stewart from Letchworth, who was accused of the murder of Royston author Helen Bailey. Every day, reporters, photographers, TV crews, detectives and members of the public, as well as family members and friends of the victim and the accused, were at court to hear the often harrowing details. The public gallery was full every day and so was the press box. At the end of the 7-week trial, Stewart was found guilty of the murder, preventing legal burial and 3 counts of perverting the course of justice, and Judge Bright sentenced him to life imprisonment with a minimum term of 34 years behind bars. Friday's valedictory for Judge Bright was held in courtroom number 5 at Luton Crown Court and was attended by staff barristers and fellow judges. Many other colleagues and friends of the judge were able to link up to the proceedings via video links. Those paying tribute to Judge Bright spoke of his compassion and wisdom and the way he was always able to command affection and respect from the advocates appearing before him. And the present resident judge of Luton Crown Court, Judge Mark Bishop, who has been in the role since August 2019, told how Judge Bright had been a source of great encouragement and support to him. Judge Bright praised the staff at his farewell event. He said, "I want to thank you all for making my time at Luton Crown Court such a happy time." Andrew Bright is retiring as a judge to take up a teaching post at the University of Hertfordshire in Hatfield, where he will teach law to students. He said the role was something he has wanted to do for a long time.
Hello, this is Ian. Leading St Albans beer writer Roger Protts has turned the spotlight on Britain's long-standing beer producers in his new book, which is published this week. Published by Camera, the Campaign for Real Ale, The Family Brewers of Britain celebrates the contribution to British brewing made by its family brewers. They are the often overlooked flag bearers for real ale and have fascinating stories to tell of the early days of commercial brewing. Fully illustrated, with modern and archive photography of the breweries, their pub estates, people and beers, this book will examine the past, the present and the future of these great brewing companies and help to highlight the important part they continue to play in the nation's brewing story and in their local areas. Britain's oldest brewery, Shepherd Neame, based in Faversham in Kent, opened in 1698 and has a large number of pubs in Kent and London. Several more breweries opened in the Georgian period and were followed by a wave of new producers in the 19th and 20th centuries. Roger said, "There has been so much attention paid in recent years to the new wave of small craft breweries that many people are unaware of the 32 family brewers who have been in business for several centuries. They are brewers who have survived wars, the threat of invasion from France, punitive attacks by politicians during World War I, and saw attempts to take them over and close them in the 1960s and 70s. The book includes local brewer McMullen in Hertford, who date from 1827 and who owns several pubs in the St Albans area, including the historic Peahen Coaching Inn in the city centre. McMullen's has a rags-to-riches story, Roger said. It's a classic case of poacher-turned-gamekeeper. Early members of the family include one denounced as a rogue and vagabond, while one son behaved so badly he was sent packing to the United States. Yet by 1887 the family was so successful that it moved into Hertford Castle, and since then successive members have been mayors and Lord Lieutenants of Hertfordshire. In common with all the family brewers, the McMullens have had their share of disputes and almost closed at the end of World War II as a result of death duties," Roger said. "But the brewery survived and is run today by two young brothers, Tom and Alexander, who are developing new beer styles that will make the brewery fit for purpose in the new age."
My next story is about how the next object of the year could be a century-old scone. Museums across the county have nominated their Hertfordshire Year of Culture 2020 Museum Object of the Year, which include a Black Lives Matter placard, an old scone, and some toilet cream. During September, the public will be asked to vote for their favourite object nominated by 13 of the county's museums. Nominations include a 105-year-old scone made in Harpenden, the Mill Green Mill located between Wellengarden City and Hatfield, and Letchworth-based Garden City Collection's Noosa Line Theatrical Toilet Cream. Other entries include Stevenage Museum's Handmade Doll's House, St Albans South's Signal Box with Lever Frame, North Hertfordshire Museum's Record Peter and Speedy Stephen, which are monkeys on bicycles, and Hitchin-based British School Museum's Victorian Spiky Toy from the Jill Grey Collection. Some entries are topical and in line with the COVID-19 pandemic which has plaited this year. A straw plaiting peg doll demonstrates that working at home was the norm in much of the county in 1851 and Theatrical Cream made in Letchworth has been nominated to demonstrate solidarity with theatres across the county in these difficult times. St Albans Museums have also put forward a placard from a recent Black Lives Matter protest in the city. Other museums may have taken note of the success of previous winners, such as in 2018 when Watford Museum's Charlie the Chimp, a mechanical toy which had pride of place in a Watford shoe shop for many years. Last year, the crown was awarded to an 86-year-old toilet roll from the Garden City collection. It was manufactured in 1936 by Letchworth chemist E.E. Russell, who ran a chemist's on Station Road from 1911, and it is considered to be the oldest surviving toilet roll in Hertfordshire. Hertfordshire County Council's Cabinet Member for Education, Libraries and Localism, Councillor Terry Dorris, said, "It's great to see such a variety of objects nominated for the Hertfordshire Year of Culture Museum Object of the Year Award, and a wonderful way for people to find out about some of Hertfordshire's excellent museums and what they have to offer." Voting closes at midnight on Sunday, September 27th at hertfordshiremuseums.org.uk/object-of-the-year-2020.aspx.
The St Albans Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament displayed a banner in the city centre to protest spending on nuclear weapons. Members of the group put the banner up in St Peter's Street every Saturday in July and August, describing the £205 billion spend on UK's nuclear weapons as immoral, illegal and useless. Campaign spokesperson Laurie Gibson said, "In these troubled times, just think of all the useful things on which this money could be spent, instead of these illegal, useless and exorbitantly expensive weapons of mass destruction." According to the group, their protest was met with very positive response from the public, with many thumbs up and expressions of support. The local CND objects to nuclear weaponry on moral, legal, economic, military, environmental and religious grounds, citing the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Art exhibition. A St Albans art exhibition with a theme inspired by the pandemic is opening soon. Incorporating power, pride and rebirth, the exhibition will be held at the Casitas on Hollywell Hill and is one of a group of events being run by Aisha Addy of Collective Gallery. The 42-year-old who has organised the event said she is passionate about showcasing the work of local artists and in particular working with marginalised groups. Her vision is to make art accessible for all, empowering people with a voice and giving them a space for them to express their ideas through their artwork. Aisha said, "I'm sensitive to the challenges that emerging artists face and want to create an opportunity where they could exhibit work in a gallery space. I'm very passionate about creating art with young people, women and other underrepresented groups." The exhibition will feature work from Aisha and other artists from our city, such as Oliver Kellett, an NA artist, NA spelled E-N-N-E artist. There will be a private viewing on September the 25th, and the main exhibition will take place on September 29th and 30th.
Bim Afalami, MP, has called on the businesses of Hitchin and Harpenden to sign up to the government's new Kickstart scheme for young people. The £2 billion initiative has been designed to help people aged between 16 and 24 into employment following the coronavirus pandemic. Under the scheme that looks set to launch next December, employers that sign up will be able to offer youngsters who are claiming universal credit a six-month work placement that is fully funded by the government. Those on Kickstart scheme will have their national minimum wage, national insurance and pension contributions paid for by central government, up to 25 hours per week. Mr. Afalami said, "We cannot allow young people to be left behind as a result of the coronavirus pandemic, and schemes like this will be vital for creating jobs and giving young people the skills to access them. I'm delighted the government are putting young people at the heart of its plans to build back stronger after the pandemic, and hope as many as possible in Hitchin and Harpenden are able to take part.
Here are the names of people who have recently died, as announced in this week's Hearts Advertiser. Gillian Elaine Fuel, no age given, and Wendy Ann Bellinger, aged 76. May they rest in peace.
My next story is about Theo Michaels, a Harpenden chef who's just launched a family meal planning service, and the article is accompanied by a picture of Theo holding his laptop showing the new weekly meal planner that he's created. A celebrity chef from Harpenden has launched a meal planning service to help make life easier and take the stress out of deciding what to prepare for your family each night. MasterChef semi-finalist and author Theo Michaels and his wife Anna have set up 5dinners.com, which aims to do all the hard work for you when it comes to sorting your dishes of the day. Each week, Theo creates 5 new family-friendly recipes with 1 complete shopping list, which is then emailed out to subscribers and also available electronically. The family man, who has lived in Harpenden for over a decade, said he decided to set up the service after becoming fed up with the stress of meal planning. He discovered a need for some sort of structure for him and his family, especially when it came to shopping for ingredients. He started meal planning and drastically reduced his food bill, found he was wasting less food, and the children loved the meals. Customers can create their own meal plans using Theo's recipes or even text him with questions. The 43-year-old, who is a regular face on TVs This Morning, said, "Now the kids are going back to school and our lives start to get busy again, we don't have all the time to cook dinner as leisurely as we might have during lockdown. In fact, it can be a real chore, deciding what to cook each night, constantly nipping to the shops to get that missing ingredient, or stuck in a rut of cooking the same thing every week. Equally, in these difficult times, many of us need to watch our expenditure, and meal planning can be a huge help, but it takes work. Setting aside time to browse through millions of online recipes, choose the dishes, prepare a shopping list. Quite simply, it isn't the pastime any of us fancy doing, especially now we're juggling after-school clubs and going to work." Theo has performed cooking demonstrations at St Albans Food and Drink Festival for the last 5 years, and most recently was in the media for his live kids cook-alongs during lockdown, where he and his family hosted 36 shows. Inspired by his Mediterranean roots, his 5th cookbook, Rustica, is out at the end of this month. Now here's a recipe for Change Your Life Spaghetti, which serves 4. "This is the recipe that made the most impact and has changed the way we cook. I love that everything goes into a tray uncooked, yes, even the spaghetti, and 30 minutes later you have a delicious entire meal ready to be served straight from the tray. It took a while to get it right, but now we cook this a lot at home. Equipment that you'll need: high-sided roasting tin, just big enough to fit the pasta in. That's important, the liquid needs to cover the pasta. Measuring jug, preheated oven, 200 degrees F. Ingredients: 300 grams of spaghetti, or other pasta, 1 onion, sliced, 2 cloves of garlic, sliced, 4 tablespoons of oil, 1 cup or 250 milliliters of passata, 650 milliliters of chicken stock, use a cube is recommended, 2 tablespoons of tomato puree, 6 sausages, basil and parmesan cheese for garnish. Note: swap sausage meat for chunks of fish, or make a vegan version with mushrooms and vegan stock. Method. Add the spaghetti to the tray and pour over the oil. Massage a little to ensure the spaghetti is coated. Then add everything else except the sausages. The tray will now be very wet with the passata and stock and should be covering the pasta by about 1 centimetre. Squeeze out bite-sized chunks of sausage meat all over the top of the dish and then bake in the oven for 30 minutes. Once cooked, remove from the oven and let it rest for 5 minutes. This is important to let it finish cooking and absorb the last of the liquid. Garnish and serve with a rather smug look across your face. You can try Theo's new service for free at 5dinners.com.
The next story has the headline, An Inspiration to Us All. Ken, 93, takes part in walking challenge in aid of church project. Inspired by Captain Tom's exploits for NHS charities, a St Albans nonagenarian embarked on his own fundraising mission. Jersey Farm's Ken Salmon, aged 93, took part in his own marathon walk of 93 laps, one lap for each year of his life and about 10 miles in total, around Harvest Court, where he lives. He has been raising funds to support Project 50, a plan to provide enhanced disabled access along with a kitchen and accessible toilet at Marshallswick Baptist Free Church in Sherwood Avenue, St Albans. This local charity is keen to provide better facilities for the community from their 50-year-old premises, and building work on this first phase is due to start this week. Ken said, I wanted to do something to support the fundraising effort as the church does a lot to help the local community. Although each lap is only around 200 yards, it is a challenge when you use a walking frame like I do, and the whole walk has been calculated at about 10 miles in total. The local community, including local MP Bim Afolami, turned out in socially distanced force to congratulate Ken on his achievement, and he has been grateful for the many donations he has received towards the church building project. He was also presented with a cake specially baked for the occasion by a local resident. Ken added, I have been overwhelmed by the level of generosity shown by friends and family and by people that I don't know who have contributed to this project. The church is a wonderful place and I have been very happy to play my part in helping provide the facilities that we all want to see. Minister Reverend Graham Clark said, Ken is an inspiration to us all, and we are very grateful to all those who have supported this cause. We are very close to achieving the total required and are having a final push to hit the target. Although a number of our regular events remain closed at the moment, Sunday morning services have reopened, and it is great to see people returning. Although we do upload podcasts to our website at www.mbfc.org.uk for those who are unable to attend. And the story is accompanied by a picture of Ken with his walking frame going out for a walk with Bim Afolami, who is waving the chequered flag.
Family discover burglar with bag full of jewellery in the middle of raiding their home. A St Albans family returned home to discover a burglar clutching a Louis Vuitton bag in which he had stuffed their jewellery. Michael Pomeroy, aged 36, handed back the bag and told them he had intervened when he saw the house in Townsend Drive was being burgled. But, St Albans Crown Court heard, the victims were suspicious of the line he had spun and chased him after he escaped on a bike. Prosecutor Neil King said Pomeroy got away, but he and a woman accomplice were later arrested. A bedroom at the back of the address had been ransacked and jewellery had been taken was found on her. Pomeroy, of no fixed address, but previously from Boreham Wood, appeared for sentence for one domestic burglary, a series of commercial burglaries, common assault, and criminal damage committed between May 2018 and February 2019. He asked for 8 commercial burglaries and 1 theft committed in Hertfordshire to be taken into consideration. He had 44 convictions and 88 previous offences. His woman accomplice, from the St Albans break-in is still on the run. Mr King said most of the other offences were daytime walk-in commercial burglaries, where he had picked up items and stolen them. Defending, Nicholas Magg said he had been in custody for 18 months. Since the lockdown, he has been spending 23 hours a day in his cell and had not been able to attend courses or see his partner or children. He said that on a number of occasions when committing crimes, he was the worse for wear. Although he had an appalling record, Mr. Magg said, he walked away when he was confronted. Jailing him for 5 years and 5 months, Judge Philip Gray said that the victims of St Albans burglary would have felt downright frightened to have returned from a lunch out to find Pomeroy leaving their home with a bag containing their jewellery. He said every householder has the right to feel safe and secure in their own home. The feeling of violation and anger is entirely justified.
Hertfordshire Business Awards will return bigger and better in 2021 after cancellation. After intense deliberation, the difficult decision has been made to cancel this year's Hertfordshire Business Awards. The events team at Argent, publishers of the Hearts Advertiser, Well in Hatfield Times, Comet and the Royston Crow have been closely monitoring the growing concerns surrounding COVID-19. In case it became untenable to continue with the awards ceremony at Nebworth Barnes on November the 26th. But with their primary responsibility being to maintain the health and well-being of the awards community, specifically sponsors, staff and event attendees, it was apparent that the event could not go ahead. The 2019 ceremony saw proud business owners filling the marquee and enjoying bubbly, a three-course meal and a range of entertainment. But none of this would be possible this year with the current social distancing measures in place. Hearts and Cams Group editor Mark Adams said the decision was gutting, but the best course of action to take. When we weighed up our awards versus the health and safety of our community, unfortunately there was only one course of action to take. We all know how much the business community enjoys coming together to celebrate everything that is great about the Hertfordshire region. But as you are still aware, the COVID-19 situation continues to evolve rapidly and it is important that we take the advice of our government authorities. Whilst this was a gutting decision to have to make, I am confident that we will be back in 2021, where our event will be bigger and better than before. Matt added, the quality of the award entries this year was, as always, very impressive and would like to thank those who took the time to enter. We look forward to seeing those businesses take part in our 2021 awards. I would also like to thank our sponsors who have supported us throughout the COVID-19 crisis. Their commitment to our awards has been unwavering.
Home staff and residents off to the seaside thanks to charity minibus donation. Day trips to the seaside are on the cards for staff and residents at a St Albans care home thanks to the donation of a minibus. Voss House in Ermine Close was presented with the keys to a disabled accessible Citroen Relay minibus by the West Hearts Charity Trust, which supports and assists local charities by providing training and vehicles. For the past 18 months, the care home, which is managed by not-for-profit care provider Quantum Care, has been raising funds for their own minibus with a target of £8,000 to hit. This included a food share scheme where the staff give donations on a weekly basis for food that would otherwise go to landfill due to packaging not passing trading standards guidelines. Any leftover food is then donated to food banks. But then Foss House was chosen to receive the charity's 99th converted minibus, joining the ranks of many other organisations who have been presented with a vehicle, including hospices, scout groups and schools. Home manager Zoe Hiscock said, "We are thrilled with the minibus and cannot wait until outings can be resumed again. When we first decided to start fundraising, it seemed an impossible task to raise such a large amount of money. We wouldn't have done it without the kind, generous donations received from family members. and the funds raised by the staff from our cafe contributions and our weekly food share. I am so incredibly proud of every single member of the team here. With huge thanks and gratitude to West Hearts Charity Trust. What an amazing charity. The donation also included the minibus being sign-written, so we hope to be seen out and about in the local community. Foss House resident Maureen said, "It is absolutely marvellous. I am looking forward to going to Southend at the weekend when we are allowed to go on outings again." Charity trustee Richard Menashe said, "We understand how important it is for Foss House residents to be able to get out and about, especially after the lockdown, and we are pleased to help."
And this is an article from the St Albans and Harpenden Review. The opening of St Albans' first budget supermarket has been delayed for another few months. Aldi was scheduled to open in Griffiths Way, near St Albans Abbey Station, this month, but now the launch appears to have been put on hold. Aldi confirmed in a tweet earlier this week that the opening had been delayed until 2021 and did not give a specific date of when it will open its doors for the first time. The company was replying to a Twitter user who suggested the supermarket will be opening in St Albans on September the 24th. Aldi replied, "I'm sorry, Raf. The store opening has been delayed until 2021. We're sorry for any disappointment caused. It means bargain hunters will have to wait a few more months to try out the new budget store." Aldi has existing sites in Hemel Hempstead, Watford and Hatfield. Alongside Aldi, a Costa drive-through will be opening as well as a B&Q. Constructors MCS Group tweeted in August that finishing touches were being applied to the B&Q development. The stores have been built on the derelict gasworks formerly owned by National Grid, which lies between The Range and McDonald's. Aldi has been approached for further details.
And now for the second part in the virtual tour of the St Albans Museum and Gallery, which Ian played you the first part of in last week's recording.
Hi, this is Sarah here, the curator of St Albans Museum and Gallery. Last week we had a bit of an introduction to the building. Now I am in the courtroom, so I've just stepped through the door. Usually this would be our cafe and you'd be hearing clinking of teacups and saucers and lots of conversation and people tapping away at their laptops. Of course, it's empty now. The courtroom is in its form as it was when it opened, largely. Obviously now there's some additional cafe furniture, but most of the furniture in here is as it was originally. One thing that I have been asked a couple of times is people who came in this space before we were a museum remember a very dark wood, and they wonder if we've changed all the furniture. No, that dark colour was actually painting that was done for a television crew who came to film in this space. A lot of films and television programmes use this space as a courtroom for their shows, so it had been painted for that. The wood, as it is here now, is painted still. It's hand-painted wood grain, and that is how it would have been originally in the 1830s. They chose a relatively inexpensive wood and then painted it to make it look more expensive. And our restorers did the same thing. They found a handbook from the 1840s and they mimicked that wood grain pattern. So if you come in this room, almost every piece of wood you see is hand painted, which absolutely blows my mind every time I see it. It's a lovely light space with the big lantern above our heads bringing lots of light in, but that also means it's quite an echoey space, as you can probably hear. There is some sound baffling that we've put in, and also having the furniture in here makes it a bit quieter, but judges and magistrates always complained about the sound in here. In fact, the dock was quite early on in its life moved slightly further forwards because the magistrates were complaining that they couldn't hear the defendants speaking. So it is a challenge that this room has always had. And there were a lot of cases heard here. We are not talking about murder cases. The laws of Britain changed in the 1830s, and that meant that they'd moved a lot of those cases to the county court at Hertford. So we don't get murder here, and we don't get some of those really big cases, but we do get a lot of other things, a lot of theft, fraud, assault. We know that a number of people were transported to Tasmania, or Van Diemen's Land, as it was known at the time, from this courtroom. So we have the records of those, including some quite young people transported for really simple crimes, stealing a cricket bat, stealing some food. We also then have those cases that come right up to the modern day. So you start to get noise disputes and also a lady who owns too many cats and they're causing a hazard to all of her neighbours. So it was in operation from 1831 to 1967. And if you visit the courtroom when we reopened, you're able to have a look at some of the cases that happened here. One of the other really famous things that happened in this courtroom was the bribery commission. So in 1851, the upright and very law-abiding people of St. Albans were found to have been so corrupt that almost all of the votes had been bought for the election, and a commission was held here in the courtroom to try and work out exactly how many votes had been bought. We're talking about a time when the electors had to be property-owning people, so it's not the whole population of St. Albans, but a huge proportion of them had been bought off. And the case was heard in the courtroom, and we have some incredible drawings by an artist called Buckingham who sketched the whole court. So he sketched the different people hearing the case, but also a lot of the witnesses and a lot of the excuses they were giving, including a woman who'd taken the money and then told her husband how to vote, people who had been grabbed and taken off for meals to encourage them to vote. What happened was that we lost both of our MPs for a number of years. So it was quite a serious occasion at the time. I'm absolutely sure that the residents of St. Albans are much more law-abiding and democratic now. But it was an interesting case to happen here. We were very lucky when we worked with the Hayward Gallery in our opening year in 2018 to have an artist called Marcel van Eeden use one of the cases that was heard here as inspiration for a new work he did. That was a case of a body that had been found out near Smallford, and the inquest was heard here in St. Albans, and then the murder trial was heard elsewhere. So there are some exciting stories to be had, and you can explore some of them on our website and some of them when you come back to see us soon.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, September 12th. The 3pm drama on Radio 4 is The English Lesson by Tamsin Oglesby. Farouk, a recent immigrant to the UK, becomes friends with his teacher. But a sharing of language is not the same as mutual cultural understanding and unexpected waves ensue. On BBC Radio 4 Extra at 4pm, A Song at Twilight by Noel Coward. This adaptation, first presented in 1988, stars Michael Denison, Jill Bennett and Dulcie Gray. And in Great Lives at 5.30 on Radio 4 Extra, Matthew Paris invites actor Ian McKellen to celebrate the legacy of mountaineer Edmund Hillary, 1919-2008. And for music lovers, the last night of the proms is on Radio 3 at 8pm, live from the Royal Albert Hall, but of course with no audience. This climax of a prom season, like no other, features South African soprano Golda Schultz and violinist Lisa Biachishvili with the BBC Singers and BBC Symphony Orchestra. And for many of us, it also means the end of summer. On to Sunday, September 13th. And at 10.30 on BBC World Service, in Heart and Soul, Father Joe Gormley tells the story of what it's like to serve parishioners in a housing estate that has been at the heart of the sectarian conflict in Northern Ireland. He administered the last rites to the journalist Lyra McKee, who was shot dead a few hundred yards from his church in Derry in April 2019. 10.30am on Sunday, September 13th. In the listening service at 5pm on Radio 3, Tom Service asks why we seem to love music from the day we were born. Are we born musical? Repeated at 4.30pm. Also on Radio 3 at 5.30pm, marking this year's 125th anniversary of Tower Bridge across the Thames, The Bridge presents readings by Papa Esidiu and Alice St. Clair of bridge-related works by W.H. Auden, Seamus Heaney, T.S. Eliot, William Wordsworth and others, and music by Wagner, Gershwin, Britten and Bobby Gentry. And at 7.15pm over on Radio 4 you can hear Teeth, the first of four episodes of Dot, a wartime period comedy set in the personnel department of the Cabinet Rooms. It was first broadcast in 2017. On to then programmes that are broadcast each day at the same time during the week, Monday to Friday. So the same radio station at the same time each day. Book of the Week, 9.45am on Radio 4, is Eat the Buddha, Barbara Demick's story of modern Tibet's troubled history through the eyes of the people of Ngaba, a town that made international headlines in 2009 when dozens of Tibetans shocked the world by self-immolating. It's repeated just after 12:30. In case you missed it when it was first broadcast in 2017, a dramatisation by Timberlake Vertenbaker of the Neapolitan novels by Elena Ferrante starts on Radio 4 Extra at 10am with part one of the first in the quartet, My Brilliant Friend. Set in the 1950s, the story tells of the lifelong friendship between two girls growing up in the poor outskirts of Naples. It's repeated each day at 3 p.m. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 a.m. this week on Radio 4 is Lifelines by Al Smith. A jogger phones emergency call centre worker Carrie to say she has found an abandoned newborn baby. It's repeated each night at 7:45. Composer of the week on Radio 3 at 12 noon is Johann Pachelbel, a composer of brilliant choral and keyboard music who was a huge influence on J.S. Bach. On Radio 4 at just after midday, each day, Monday to Friday, No Longer at Ease, Chinua Achebe's classic novel portrays the corrupt system of government in Nigeria in the 1960s. Abridged by Jane Rogers, it is read by Patterson Joseph and repeated each night, 10:45. Then at 1:45 in the afternoon on Radio 4 in Bloodlands, acclaimed foreign correspondent Andrew Harding recounts the story of a murder investigation in South Africa in 2016 that highlighted festering racial tensions in the country. Still on Radio 4 at 3:30, Ben Bailey reads the first of five stories on the shortlist for the National Short Story Award. And lastly, Mayflower Portraits is the subject of the essay over on Radio 3 at 10:45, in which five writers throughout the week reflect on the impact of the Pilgrim Fathers setting sail on the Mayflower 400 years ago. Back to Monday, September 14th then, and highlights for this day. Creating a safe and effective vaccine for COVID-19 is only the first part of a long and complex process. Vaccines, Money and Politics. 11 a.m, Radio 4 looks at the vast ecosystem needed to deliver a vaccination programme to the world in record time. The lunchtime concert at 1 o'clock on Radio 3. Andrew McGregor introduces the first of 4 weeks of concerts live from Wigmore Hall in London. Today with cellist Alban Gethart and pianist Marcus Becker playing works by Schumann, Shostakovich and Beethoven. The afternoon drama at 2 p.m. on Radio 4 is Oil on Water. Two reporters risk everything in search of the story after the British wife of an oil company executive is kidnapped in the oil-rich Niger Delta. Tuesday, September 15th, in The Green Lady in the Toilets at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4, singer-songwriter Emmy the Great seeks inspiration in an audio tour of school playgrounds, with children telling stories of ghostly individuals from The Green Lady to Bloody Mary. She reflects on the role they play in helping young people make sense of life, as well as, inevitably, death. The afternoon drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is Brother of Mine by Nathaniel Price. Walter has always looked up to his older brother, but their relationship is put to the test when Nigel is accused of a serious crime. Still on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. though, Mental Health Killings, A Crisis in Care, is a File on 4 investigation into whether mental health support is always available when people need it most. It's repeated Sunday at 5 p.m. And don't forget, it's Tuesday, so this week's In Touch is at 8:40 p.m. on Radio 4. Wednesday, September 16th, and if you feel in need of a bit of vintage comedy, why not tune to BBC Radio 4 Extra? 12 noon for Hancock's Half Hour, with Tony Hancock and company, followed at 12:30 by Up the Garden Path with Imelda Staunton. Both those repeated at 7 o'clock and 7:30 p.m. if you can't do it at lunchtime. 2:15, play on Radio 4 is Not for Turning, Tim Dawson's comedy drama about wide-eyed young Hal attending his first Conservative Party conference, where his awakening is more than just political. In the Classic FM concert at 8 p.m, John Suchet presents an evening of popular works by Rossini, Beethoven, Bach, Bizet and Haydn, which initially were not generally well received. Also at 8 p.m. on Radio 4, there's a new series of The Spark, in which Helen Lewis meets writers and thinkers who are breaking new ground. This evening's guests tell her why they feel the world is enthralled to destructive individualism. Next, Thursday, September 17th, on Radio 4 at 11:30, Songs of the Humpback Whale, a programme marking the 50th anniversary of bioacoustian Roger Payne's unlikely smash hit LP. Radio 4, 11:30 in the morning. More vintage comedy on Radio 4 Extra with a 1960 episode of Beyond Our Ken at 12 midday, and Yes Minister from 1984 at 12:30. Again repeated at 7 and 7:30 if you miss it. Also at 7:30 in the evening, Radio 3 in concert offers another chance to hear Bruckner's monumental Eighth Symphony and works by Ives performed by the Cleveland Orchestra in a 2010 concert recorded at the Edinburgh International Festival. And in Free Thinking at 10 p.m. on Radio 3, Rana Mitter hosts a discussion on family ties, power networks and history, from the influence of Sikh queens through the ties of marriage and religion which helped shape the Western world, back to the links between Neanderthals and early man. And lastly for this week, we come to Friday, September 18th. And the afternoon drama on Radio 4 at 2:15 is Read the Moon by Viv Crosscop. After years of hard graft, 38-year-old actress Sally has finally landed the role of a lifetime in a movie franchise. But the executive producer has asked to meet her alone in a hotel suite before he agrees to sign off on her. Starring Melody Grove and Tim McInerney. 6:30 p.m, Radio 4 Extra, Dominic Arkwright leads a discussion on positive thinking in Off the Page. It was first broadcast in 2006, a programme from the past that helps us face the future. Radio 3 in concert at 7:30 p.m. offers another chance to hear Verdi's powerful Requiem, recorded in 2013 at the Edinburgh International Festival. And to round off the week, at 10 p.m. on Radio 3, Ian McKillen returns with The Verb, the series celebrating fine poetry and performance. Tonight he's joined by the poet laureate Simon Armitage and Lahore-born British poet Monisa Alvi. And as ever, may I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
We have now come to the end of this recording. So from Claire, Alison, Kalpana, Peter, Jilly, Ian and John, and from me, Alex, goodbye, stay safe, and here's to the next time.